I run this songwriting retreat in the fall, and I say to the songwriters who attend, like, creativity and art, like, you need to waste time. You need to, like, spend an entire day and chase an idea and then throw it in the garbage. That's not always, like, practical, but you need to have the space to be able to, like, waste time and chase something and be curious and not have it turn into anything, so that at some point you can get that little golden nugget that does turn into something.
Hey, welcome to the Growth Mixtape Podcast, and I'm your host, Bob Mathers. Now, before we get started, I'd love to ask a quick favor. If you like what we're doing here, please follow the podcast wherever you listen. It helps you find new episodes quickly in your feed, and it helps us promote our profile so we can continue bringing you amazing guests like this one. Please share this episode with anyone you think needs to hear it. And if you want even more of this awesomeness we're serving up, join my 100% free Substack at substack.bobmathers.com or get the link in the show notes. So today we talk to Peter Katz, and Peter is an award-winning singer, songwriter, speaker, and creator of the Keynote Concert, which is so good, I really wish I had thought of it. I talked to Peter on the eve of the release of his new album, Everything Unfolding, which was the perfect opportunity to talk to an artist about what it's like to pour your heart and soul into something and then let it out into the world for it to be reviewed and judged and not be crushed if the reaction isn't what you expect. We talk about how to find your voice in a sea of content and how to create work that is intensely personal but somehow still puts your audience at the center of it all. I love how he talks about filling our tank of possibilities in the creative process and how we all need to get more comfortable wasting time. And how does all this creative magic apply to authentic leadership, connection, and even holding better meetings? Well, for that, you're going to have to listen. But trust me, it is solid gold. Please enjoy Peter Katz. All right, welcome Peter Katz to the show. I can't tell you how excited I am for this.
Well, I'm looking forward to this as well, Bob.
So I've got a ton of things to dig into, but just a couple of things quickly. So, of course, I'm doing my research. I'm watching you on YouTube. I'm listening to a bunch of stuff on Spotify. And I realize that you have an album dropping in 2 days. And I put myself in your situation, and I'm wondering what it's like to pour your heart and soul into something and then be on the precipice of unleashing it on the world for it to be judged and listened to. And what's that process like? Because personally, I think I would find that really, I don't know, I'd be riddled with anxiety, but I'm sure you have a much healthier relationship with it than I do.
Well, it's funny. I've probably released 8 or 9 albums. I should know. I've been down the road before, and I would say I've had very different experiences each time. Like the last one I put out was supposed to come out April 3rd, 2020. And had 3,000 copies of it sitting in my condo for the next 2 years. For that album, I made this like big pop album, and I had the whole like machine behind me, and we're going to do like the full band touring, and like, you know, had like the light show, like we had like the everything teed up, and obviously the whole thing evaporated with the pandemic. And with this album, it feels different than anything else I've ever done before, because I'm a very intentional person, but to me, I didn't put a lot of intention behind the album in the sense of like, oh, this is going to go do this in the world, and this is how this fits into my career, and these are the touring plans. And like, in many ways, I had no intention to make an album. I just connected with one of my dear friends, Rich Jacks, who's like an amazing producer. And we had made a lot of music in the past before, but we were just talking about life and meditation and, you know, the big ideas and just philosophizing and just kind of connecting with each other and deepening our friendship. And then music kind of unfolded from there. And he ended up coming up to my place in the woods and spent 10 days. And again, we were sort of hanging out and just making music. And so the way that this album is kind of coming out sort of feels aligned with how the whole thing came together, where I haven't been overthinking it. So much of the album is first take on the vocal, even sometimes first take on the performance of something. And, you know, when I was working with the graphic designer for it, who I've worked with for 15 years, he would send me something and I'd be like, that's great. Whereas in the past, he would have been, you know, we would have had like 47 back and forths and iterations, but I just kind of let it be what it wanted to be. And I feel like in many ways, the release of the album is the same, where I don't really have any kind of marketing engine behind it. I'm not doing all the things. And yet I've put these singles out. I've put a bunch of the singles out and it's already just finding its way in all these unique ways. And in fact, it already has like the biggest listenership of anything I've ever done, even though I'm not forcing it in any way.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And there's this idea, of course, that, you know, when you create work, the first time I was exposed to this was sort of in Rick Rubin's book, but I'm sure he's not the first person to say it, where you're, you know, the role of the artist is to create. And once you put it out into the world, your job is done and you're not supposed to care about what happens after that. But I know it's not that simple. So it sounds like you've got a pretty healthy relationship with it, but how do you resist the urge to be checking streams and reviews, or maybe you don't? And maybe I wonder that how that's changed over the years.
Yeah. I mean, I obviously still want, like, I would love nothing more than for millions and millions and millions of people to hear it and connect with it. And I feel like, you know, of all the things I've ever made, it's the most focused on the listener. It feels like the most, the least about me and the most about them. So I would love for people to hear it. Obviously I'm like noticing that there's, you know, more and more, you know, streams that are happening, which I'm excited about, and all of that feels good. But ultimately, I'm just sort of trying to continue the spirit of how it was made, which is from this pure place of friendship, of being in nature, of loving music, and of trusting that it will find its way. And of course, you know, I'm going to like post some things on social media about it and write a newsletter about it. And, you know, we have a press release going out about it on Friday. So like, there'll still be some of those efforts, and I'm doing like a release show, but I'm trying to hold it lightly. And the other thing I think about too is, you know, even when I started in the music business, which is like 20 years ago, which is hard to believe, like the album launch was like everything just drove towards this moment, and you needed like a big splash of a moment when the album comes out. But I feel like in this current day and age, like it can kind of find its audience at any time. And so it's, there's less of an emphasis on this one big day, and versus like it can have a long shelf life. I mean, it's sitting in a sea of content. Like I remember when I first started, there was like, I don't know, the count was like, you know, 5,000 albums a year were coming out, and then it went to like 10, and then it went to 35. And now, you know, now it's like, I don't know, like hundreds of thousands of, you know, come out, just the amount of content. So in many ways it sort of takes the pressure off, because it's like, well, this is out there now, and I can guide people to it over a longer period of time, and they can find it in due time as well. And so I don't know. I just feel less attached, even though it's like, it's my favorite thing I've ever made. Mm. Kind of interesting.
Yeah. Less attached. That's interesting. And it's interesting you say it feels more like it's focused on the listener as opposed to you. And I mean, maybe we can touch about this later when you talk about your speaking, because I was wondering how that actually is quite different than what I've heard a lot of songwriters talk about, where they're just trying to write for themselves. And hopefully the truer it can be to something that's going to resonate with them, the more it will, you know, the more it will find its audience. But that's very different than what you'd have to do in speaking, where it's all about the audience. I wonder if maybe this, maybe some of the work that you do around speaking and be so focused on the audience has maybe changed how you wrote this album.
Yeah. And I totally agree with what you're saying is like, you know, the more sort of personal you can be, the more universal it is. And the more you sort of try to be universal, the more it can be kind of generic and not really matter to anybody. So certainly it still remains personal, but I think I have to like think more deeply on this, but I think part of it is you still go to that deep inner place, but you don't force it. You don't like try to manipulate it. Like you sort of trust that the way that it's coming out is the way that it wants to come out. And so I guess it's almost like an energetic thing around it, where it's not that I'm sitting there thinking like, oh, people are going to love this. And cause I think that's a recipe for disaster. I think there's so much truth in what you said is like, it has to come from you. It has to be of you. But I think there's something about holding all of that very lightly, in some ways, like taking yourself not as seriously. Because I think sometimes we try to like perfect something because of our insecurity, or like we want it to be perfect. We don't want our voice to have a little crack in it, or we want to like rehearse it so that it's like perfect. But that's not necessarily what the listener is going to resonate or engage with, or that's not what's necessarily is going to make them feel human to human as they listen to it. And so it takes courage to kind of let it be how it is. And you know, Rick Rubin is a great example of somebody who kind of produces in that way and you know, sort of holds things lightly. Mm. And to answer the second part of your question, yes, I would say the speaking work that I do, and for people that don't have context on that, so I do these things called keynote concerts where you know, I go with in organizations and, you know, institutions and associations. And I deliver these keynotes that, of course, have music and storytelling as part of them as well. And you're absolutely right. In that context, part of what I loved about speaking as soon as I discovered it, in many ways, is this sort of separation between artist and audience, where you have to sort of be this, you know, enigma and mysterious and untouchable, and, you know, like all of that is gone. And I'm a naturally very earnest person, and I like to just kind of be myself. And I felt like in the speaking world, it was like, oh yeah, we're here to feel something and learn something and connect around. Like it was just obvious. And so it sort of created this freedom to like, not make it about me. The audience is right there. Like I can see them in a way that I often can't see them in a, you know, dimly lit space. And really I am there to serve them. Like if you think about an organization that's, you know, bringing together 1,000 of their employees or whatever, like that's 1,000 people that are not working in that moment. They're listening to me. And so they better get a return on that investment by me being able to give them something that's going to help them go live their lives, do their work, you know, et cetera, feel inspired. And so I think that ethos has sort of worked its way into everything that I do.
Yeah. Well, there's a couple things I want to come back to there, Peter, but first and by the way, before I forget, I looked you up on Spotify. Full disclosure, I had never listened to your music before. And I started with, I think there's about a half, maybe 4 or 5 songs from the new album that are out already. Right.
Yeah.
Even though it doesn't drop for a couple of days.
Yep.
And I didn't really know what to expect. I was like, yeah, it's part of my research. I'll see what, you know, I can paint. And I, no shit, really, really liked it. Like it is going into the regular rotation. I didn't know what to expect, but I was surprised. And I'm actually really excited to dig into some of the deeper cuts in your back catalog.
Thank you. I feel very excited about it. And I feel like it is special. And I I hope I'm not saying that from a place of ego. I feel like it has something very special. And for those that are, you know, open to finding it and spending some time with it, there's a lot there. I think that people could enjoy and be served by.
Yeah, I'm sure of that. Absolutely. Okay, so definitely some. I've got a long list of things that I'm super excited to talk to you about. I wish we had time to go through your whole origin story because you've got a few really interesting things that have happened and have shaped you. I just wanted to pick on a couple of them, though. The first thing that struck me was that you've been living alone since you were 16.
Yes.
I think back about myself at 16. I don't think I would have survived a week. I have two kids in my early 20s. I don't think they would survive a day. So how do you end up being alone when you're 16? And, you know, how do you think that's shaped you?
Yeah. And just for clarity, in case, like, it's not that I've like lived an alone celibate life and I continue, like, I like, so, but I moved out on my own, at 16 years old, and, definitely, you know, I wasn't even old enough. Like when I was freshly 16, I didn't even have a driver's license. And so, you know, it was just sort of the way that life unfolded with my parents' divorce and you know, my mom remarried an American, and we were living in Montreal at the time, and, you know, he didn't speak French. So she moved there to be there, and my dad moved in with somebody else. And I wasn't at the time, you know, wanting to live there. And so it was like, okay, I'm going to move out on my own. And so I had an apartment at 16 years old, and, you know, in many ways I was always sort of ahead of my age. Like, I'm the baby of four. And I think I always was trying to do what the older kids were doing. And I always was like friends with older kids. And so it was something that didn't feel too crazy. Although there were definitely moments where, like, I felt scared. You know, I remember like thinking someone was in the apartment, and you know, like those little, like, slight little boy moments where you're scared, even though you're in this context where you're supposed to be a grown up. So it definitely kind of forced my hand to grow up a little faster than maybe I should have. But I've always liked a challenge. I've always sort of tried to rise to the occasion, and in some ways, you know, I took to it pretty easily. And I don't know, it's one of those things that I've been debriefing a lot in therapy, like in more recent years. Like, I think I did the best with the circumstances as they were. It probably would have been better for me in some aspects to have not had that happen, but it is what happened. It gave me things that have helped me. It also caused some challenges that I've had to, you know, recover from, and as in all things with life, it can be our strengths can also be our weaknesses, and there's like nothing is sort of one dimensional.
I think back when I was 16, and what a massive role music played in my life. I always think of our adolescence as like you're trying, especially in high school, trying to find your identity. So there's the heavy metal group and the new wave group. And I'm wondering what role music sort of played when you're out there, you're living on your own, you're kind of finding yourself. How did that work for you?
What's interesting, I've actually never been asked that question about that time specifically, because, you know, when I was like 13, 14, 15, I was really into like the Smashing Pumpkins and Pearl Jam and kind of like the 90s, you know, grunge and alternative rock. But when I think back to that time when I first moved out, I almost have like no associations with music for like a year or two, which is probably because I like was in deep survival focus mode. So I don't actually have like a sense of what I was listening to in that period, but I know right around that time, or soon after that time, I started getting into singer-songwriters. Mm-hmm. And so I started getting into like Leonard Cohen and Joni Mitchell and Bob Dylan and Van Morrison. And as I think about it now, it kind of makes sense that I maybe was listening to more like typical teenager music when I was 13, 14, 15. And then when I had this big experience where I sort of needed to like grow up in a way, I all of a sudden was attracted to, you know, these like deeper, you know, more introspective, older, I guess, music in a way. I've never thought about that, but actually there was a marked transition between those two genres.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting. There was a period in my time, in high school, for example, where I listened to a lot of the Smiths. Mm. And I had every LP. I knew every lyric to every song. I knew who played on every track. But when I went away to school I sort of wanted to reinvent myself. So I didn't listen to the Smiths again for maybe 10 or 15 years. And then something came on the radio and I was 16 again. Like there's nothing like music is a time machine, like to throw you. I swear I could smell it. I was insecure and nervous. And yeah, it's amazing. And it's got to be pretty amazing to think that your music could do that for people when it attaches itself to a moment in their life.
Yeah, there's actually a lot of neuroscience around sort of what our brains are doing at that time in life. Because I run a mentoring program with teenagers every summer out in the Rockies in Alberta. And, you know, they're all 16 years old, 16, 17, like sort of 15 to 17, like grade 9 going to grade 10. And so we talk to them about what's sort of happening in their brains at that time with this like pruning and the neuroplasticity and all these things that are happening in their brains. And so it's not just an illusion that we bond with music in the ways that we do when we're in those years. There's actually a lot of neuroscience around what's actually happening and why, we process music in our amygdalas. It's the same place we process like our feelings. And so we actually like wire our brains to that music. And it is a really, really powerful time. It's also a reason why people sometimes sort of get stuck in like they just listen to the same music that they listened to in those formative years for the rest of their life.
Right.
Because it's like it's so deeply like literally ingrained in their physiology.
One thing that I was thinking about, because I was reading a little bit about the work that you do with teenagers, and I'm wondering, so it's interesting, it seems like around that time, or maybe in their early 20s, where people are sort of, they have to choose between maybe this passion or this art that they love, whether it's painting or music or whatever it is. And they're sort of told, well, now it's time to get serious, go to school, get a job.
Yeah.
And then I talk to a lot of people in their 50s that are like, they're trying to figure out how to bring back the passions back into their work, maybe reinventing themselves or starting something new or starting a side hustle. And it seems like maybe we should try to hold on and make a living off our people's, off of our passions, so that we didn't have this 30-year bubble in the middle where we were just doing a bunch of shit we didn't really care about.
Yeah. And I mean, we could talk a lot about that. I mean, I had a bit of a unique experience in that when I was 19, you know, just as you're starting to think about these things, I was in my first year of university and I collapsed in class, and I won't go into the whole story, but essentially they found a tumor behind my heart. They thought I had Hodgkin's lymphoma, which is this kind of cancer. And I spent, I missed the rest of the second half of my first semester. I was in the hospital and getting tests and all this kind of stuff. And ultimately, long story short, like it sort of deleted that part of my brain that was like, oh, you have all the time in the world. Mm-hmm. And so even though I was in more of a survival mode, right? I was out on my own. I was thinking about like, how do I be okay and create a future for myself, which, you know, probably would have led me to make more practical choices. I also had this other knowing inside of me that, oh, I could also like die at any moment. And so therefore I'm still going to choose to do the things that my heart is speaking to me and telling me to do. And so I feel like having that experience at that moment in my life in some ways like saved me from the 30-year bubble that you're describing. And like, it also needs to be said that there's a lot of good reasons that people like go do something more practical, because like in my case, I was, you know, playing 150, 200 shows a year. I was sleeping on floors and driving through snowstorms and not making any money. And like there was a lot of trial and tribulation that came with that choice. And, you know, I wouldn't have it any other way. Like I'm grateful that I was able to pursue that path, but I don't know that I would have pursued it unless I had had that formative experience at that age that I had it.
Yeah, that's so interesting you say that, Peter, because I think a lot of people that I talk to, and certainly in my life, I've had a couple of, you know, resets like that. My dad passed away when I was 23, and sort of, you know, I left school and helped run the business for a while and, you know, moved away, et cetera. But very quickly, I jumped back on the, well, it didn't reset me like it did you. It was just like, oh, this really shitty thing that happened. And, you know, I jumped right back on the train that I left off at, going to school, getting a job, et cetera. But then last year, my wife and I had a really scary thing happen with our son, and we, you know, we could have lost him. And that was a similar kind of reset in that we were like, no, life is too short. Like none of this shit that we've been worried about matters anymore. And we've been really resisting our life snapping back into its original shape like it did for me. And like I think it does for most people, because we all sit there at a funeral thinking, oh my God, this could, you know, it could be any one of us in that box up there. And we need to live life like it, you know, every day is if it were our last. And then 2 weeks later, we're waking up at 3 a.m. worrying about stupid shit. You seem to have managed to hold on to that at least longer, if not forever.
I mean, I wouldn't like overstate that. I definitely have the anxieties, and I you know, like I it's complicated. Like I'm not still out there playing 150, 200 shows a year. In part because like life happened in these unexpected ways, right? Like I was poised to do a bunch of big things with the last record, and like, you know, the pandemic hit and wiped out every single plan I had, and the partnership, like it was just like crushing. And at the same time, I'm a, you know, survivor, like deep in my core. And so I built this like virtual broadcast studio in my living room, and basically totally transformed my life. You know, I was probably one of the busiest speakers over the course of the, you know, 18 months of the pandemic. And that totally exploded my reach and possibilities for me in the speaking work. And so, you know, it wasn't just that I like gave up on music. It was also, there was this other opportunity that was just screaming at me of like, hey, and I was still playing music and storytelling and connecting with people in ways that I found really meaningful. And so it was this like evolution that I wasn't anticipating. But it also was more financially stable. And, you know, like I'm sure there's variables that are at play inside of me of like, oh, this work that I do over here is a little more straightforward. And, you know, do I enjoy that security at this time in my life? Yes. And maybe to agree with you, as I still actually push myself to come back to, all right, like, what really lights me up? And, and yes, that work lights me up. And I don't think I can actually do that work authentically and, you know, call myself a speaker or, you know, seek to provide inspiration for people if I'm not also doing the other work over here, which is, I know deep in my heart and soul that I always want to be an artist. I always want to make music. And if I abandon that part of myself, then I don't really think I deserve to, you know, try to inspire anybody else. And so, you know, I carry those tensions inside of me. I question myself. I ask myself, like, okay, am I willing to turn down some of this work over here so that I can have the time and the energy and the focus to do the artist's work, which, by the way, like, I run this songwriting retreat in the fall, and I say to the, you know, songwriters who attend, like, creativity and art, like, you need to waste time. You need to, like, spend an entire day and chase an idea and then throw it in the garbage. And so that's not always, like, practical, but you need to have the space to be able to, like, waste time and chase something and be curious and not have it turn into anything, so that at some point you can get that little golden nugget that does turn into something. And so I just want to be honest with people that I hold all of that inside of myself. I question myself. I wonder, should I do this? Should I do that? And so, you know, like any other human being, I hold that complexity.
Hey, it's Bob, and I'm taking the Growth Mixtape on the road in a series of live podcast episodes. Imagine a podcast tailored specifically for your company, recorded in front of a live audience that would be released as its own episode. These are thoughtful, emotional conversations that help teams who have lost their spark rediscover their curiosity and creativity so they can love work again. Sure, you could do a typical keynote or panel discussion, or you could give your team something they'll never forget. Book me at your next event at bobmathers.ca. Now back to the show. I wanted to ask about the songwriting retreats. I was going to ask later, but let's talk about it now. I'm somebody that's, my grandfather bought me a guitar when I was 9. I've played, you know, most of my life. I'm not very good. I'm a campfire enthusiast, as I call it. But in all that time, I've never written a song. And it's not because I haven't tried. I sit down and I write a couple lines and I look down on it and be like, oh, that's garbage. And I throw it out. And it's this judgment that I can't get away from in the moment of creating. It's not like I write a song and look down on it and say, that sucks. I don't even finish it because I can't even bear to look at what I'm writing as I'm doing it. And I think that's pretty common. So when you're doing these songwriting retreats, what is the biggest thing that people have to get around? Is it this idea of play? It's like, forget everything that you've learned in work and in life for the last 30 years of do this and then do this and then do this and then do this and get an outcome. It's like, you're going to waste a ton of time and it's going to be really frustrating. I don't know. I want to do it. It's just really uncomfortable.
Yeah. Well, first of all, this songwriting retreat that I run, it, like, of all the things I've done in my life, I think it's, like, my favorite thing that I do. And that's a big, big statement for me to say, because there's a lot of things that I love to do. But I literally, almost 10 years ago, I was invited to speak at a retreat in Turks and Caicos. And it was with, you know, all these people that worked in, like, the blockchain and cryptocurrency, you know, like all these, like, fascinating people. Anyways, long story short, on the final day, there was this opportunity to, like, just offer a session. And so various people at this conference, like, sort of said, oh, I can offer a session on this. I can offer a session on this. And I put my hand up. I was like, oh, I could offer a session on songwriting. And 100% of the attendees came to my session. And I ran them through this songwriting experience, because when I first took the leap of faith to go into songwriting, you know, and being a performer full time, I would go into high schools and run these songwriting workshops to sort of supplement my income. And I'd also do these songwriting workshops when I was on the road in communities. And so I had this kind of format that I had created. Anyways, I offered this songwriting workshop. People, like, you know, were in tears and they were sharing so proudly. It was, like, just this beautiful, beautiful moment. And the guy that ran the conference walked up to me and said, you need to run your own songwriting retreat. Like, he's like, you need to take what you did for us today and, like, offer that. And so that seed was planted, and it took me, you know, 8 years or whatever it was to finally have the perfect space and skill set and all the things to be able to do it. But I was like, imagine a songwriting retreat for someone who has always wanted to write a song but doesn't know how, like, exactly like what you just described. And so I put the call out there. We filled it, like, within seconds, basically. And it's just the most beautiful experience because no one's there trying to be a professional songwriter or like it, like the spirit of it is about the beauty, the challenge, the magic of creating something that doesn't exist yet. And that's what's so hard about songwriting or any kind of creation is like, you don't know, like, is it good? Is it done? Is it like, does the second verse, like no one knows or decides that other than you. And it's super helpful to have a guide on the side, sort of holding your hand and walking you through the process. And so in some ways that's what I do is there's a whole like pre-event experience where I'm kind of getting people to notice, to pay attention, to be writing, to kind of fill up the tank with possibilities. And then they arrive on site and I host it like at my cottage on the lake, like just beautiful setting. And I basically teach them this framework that I mean, I've never had somebody not write a song, and I'm not just talking about at my songwriting retreats. I mean, like I've been running this for 20 years. Like it always results in a song with this framework. So I teach them this framework. We write the song. The next day, they record the song, and again, they don't need to be a singer. They don't need to know how to play an instrument, but it's just like being in the studio, making something amazing together. And then on the final day, we do this like closing ceremony, and it's just so magical where we like hear the songs for the first time, and it's just the best thing. And I feel like what I love about it so much is you're giving people this access point to this thing that has felt impossible forever. And yet in their heart and souls, they've always wanted to do it. And the other thing is like, you're doing it together, right? So you're as much as I'm there to help them write a song, I'm also there to connect them with each other, to for all of us to feel connected so that we can do this hard thing together. And anyways, I'd love to have you there, Bob, next time. So we'll get you a song.
Oh, man. Okay, a couple of things about that. Yeah, you talk about filling up the tank of possibilities. I want to come back to that too. But it seems like there's all this raw material just sitting underneath the surface. And they just need a space and a little bit of permission and a little bit of coaching. And I can imagine that being really emotional. I wonder if it's the favorite thing you've ever done, why do you only do it once a year?
Well, I have like a 15 person waiting list for next year. So I'm going to do more than one next year. It's a very, very high touch experience. Mm-hmm. So you know, Rob, the producer, and I, who I run it with, like we are all in and very, very, very high touch. And so I don't want to like burn myself out on it by doing it every weekend. Cause I feel like I want it to be special and something that I look forward to. And so I can just give my whole energy to it, but we're definitely going to do it twice next year. And I haven't figured out like if there's a format where we could accommodate more people, but again, I wouldn't want to sacrifice how high touch and how intimate and how special it is. So, anyways, I've been reflecting on it just given the demand and the interest in it. But for now, we're going to run two next year and see kind of where it goes from there.
I absolutely will be there. Like full disclosure, you and I you had posted something on LinkedIn about it. And so I responded and I did have a conflict, but I also looked at it and I thought, I don't know, that's a little expensive. I'm not sure if I want to do that. What you just described, I would pay $20,000 for. Like that just sounds like what a life, I'm sure you hear it all the time, what a life-changing experience that is, and to arm people with this thing that they can take out and do over and over on their own.
Yeah, I mean, that's the comment that we hear on, you know, consistently on the last day is like, you know, I came here to write a song, but I'm leaving sort of with a different sense of like what's possible for me in my life. And it's cool because, you know, I had this idea like almost a decade ago, but I you know, what happened in that time between when I finally did it was, number one, I became certified as a facilitator. So I, like, during the pandemic, I was able to, you know, basically do like a master's degree. It's not called a master's degree, but I did thousands of hours of training in facilitation work. And so I really knew how to create the container for the experience. And then, like, during the pandemic, because of all the work I was able to do virtually, I was able to, you know, get this cottage. And so I had the perfect space suddenly. And, you know, it all just kind of came together. I was like, oh man, I could actually pull this off now. And so to me, yes, it's an investment for sure. I also think it's like a steal of a deal in the sense that, like, you know, if someone were to hire me to write a song, it would actually cost twice that versus coming, spending 3.5 days, you know, getting fed, being in a beautiful place and actually writing and recording the song together. So, but, you know, we definitely tried to price it. It's like, okay, how do we, you know, justify the cost and bringing in, an amazing producer and the space and my time and all that kind of stuff while also keeping it accessible. So it's like, yes, I'm taking a swing in order to do this, but the value really outweighs the price tag.
Oh man, I honestly cannot wait. I'm going to be there.
Amazing.
So I wanted to talk about some of your speaking because I know that you really pride yourself in doing some research and talking and gathering stories ahead of a lot of your keynote concerts. By the way, keynote concert, I'm like, as somebody that does speaking myself, I'm like, God damn, that's fucking brilliant. I wish I had thought of that. Not that I'm as talented as you, but I could have probably figured out how to incorporate some music in there somehow. Mm. Anyway, brilliant. When you're doing that, what are the most common challenges that leaders are facing when they bring you in? Like, what are you hearing and how are you hearing things change in the companies and the leaders that you talk to, and how do you go about putting together, you know, keynote concerts that get to the heart of some of that stuff?
Yeah, well, I mean, one thing to say out of the gate is it is constantly evolving and probably evolving more quickly than ever before. And so one of my signatures as a speaker, which, you know, you alluded to there is I never just like open a can and deliver a talk. Every single talk I do, of course, I meet with the leadership or the event planner, you know, whoever's kind of creating the convening, but I also interview some of the people that are going to be in the audience and I take their stories. I have a pretty tight framework that I've created where in like a 15-minute interview, and I'll do multiple interviews, I can get at like really amazing stories in a short period of time. And so I get at all these stories, basically all these ways that the people within the organization are already living out their mission, vision, values, purpose. And then we actually bring those things to life on stage through the sharing of those stories. And lo and behold, as you share those stories, you actually reveal the recipes of success. And you also create these waves of inspiration throughout the organization that are like these homegrown waves of inspiration. Like I do tell some of my own stories, but it's so powerful for people within the organization or within that industry or whatever it might be to hear stories that they feel a deep resonance with, but I'm able to sort of package it in a way as, you know, as a professional storyteller and sort of understanding like, hey, what matters most here and what's being shared and presenting that in a way that, you know, is hopefully compelling. But then of course, like you said, there's always different riddles that I'm trying to solve within the organization. So in the depth of the pandemic, for example, it was just like, please, 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 like help us be connected in any way, shape or form. Or you know, I did a ton of work with healthcare. It evolved over the course of the pandemic. Like at the beginning of the pandemic, it was like, hey, just, you know, love on us, like appreciate us. But then at a certain point, it's like a year later and it's like, yo, we're burning out. We're dying here. Like you can't just pat us on the head and tell us how great we are. We need actual like practical, actionable, you know, research-backed tools and resources to help us survive this time. So, you know, there was an energetic shift there. And then coming out of the pandemic, I was doing a lot of work with organizations that were navigating like hybrid and how are they coming back together and still being connected, but you know, they're in 2 days a month or, you know, whatever the different scenarios were within the different organizations. And with some organizations, I would work with them for like a year and we would run programs and connections and facilitations and over a long period of times. Other times I'm just coming in and it's more of a kind of one and done. And then coming out of that, there was like, okay, now it's back to work. Like we want to be productive. We want to get things done. And it's like, okay, what's the shift there? Now, all that said, at my core, I stand for people being connected to each other. I stand for people being, you know, showing up with authenticity, with heart. And so I'm only going to like adjust my message so much. Like there was a period where I was losing a lot of work to people who speak about AI because all of a sudden AI is the thing. Like I'm not going to all of a sudden start just giving talks about how to use AI because that's not like my area of expertise or that's not the road that I've traveled. And so in the age of AI, how do we maintain human connection and how do we actually, maybe human connection is even more valuable than ever before. So you can always sort of position yourself within the context of whatever is happening, but I sort of continue to stand for the same things. And ultimately I'd like to think, that the things that I stand for are evergreen because it's about human experience and being connected and showing up, connected to a sense of purpose and aligned with your values and bringing out kind of the best of what can be, as a human being, both personally and professionally.
So a couple of things about that. One, I think when you talked about mission and vision, I guess what I hear a lot of leaders talk about is, you know, we've got a mission and vision, and what we hear at the bottom is that we don't see our leaders living these values, making decisions in alignment with those things every day. And so there's a lot of disengagement. And I think what I'm hearing is one of the things you can do is help celebrate the stories of where those things are happening. It's not like we have to start talking about how to live our mission and vision necessarily. It's about how to celebrate those moments where it's already happening. And those stories are just getting lost in the everyday minutia of work. And yeah, they're just lost.
Yeah. That's something I talk about a lot. And, you know, I have a few different keynotes that I give, but when I'm talking about this idea of, I call it like celebrate what matters. And when I say the word celebrate, I often make this distinction to the audience. I say, hey, you know, people hear the word celebrate and they think party. Nothing wrong with a great party, but I think we party to forget, we celebrate to remember. And so if you think about, you know, we were talking about songwriting earlier, right? What am I doing when I'm writing a song? Well, you're taking an idea, a feeling, a concept, this invisible thing, and you're saying, hey, this one matters. Like this idea, this feeling, this thought matters. And then you turn it into a song. And then once it has the form of a song, then all of a sudden it can do something in the world. Like you can send it to someone you love and say, hey, this made me think of you. Or a couple can have their first dance to it, right? And so organizations don't necessarily have songs, but they have all of these ways that people within the organization are actually already living out their mission, vision, and values. There are all these stories that exist, in the corners of the institution. And so what I do is I'm like, hey, this one matters, and this one matters, and this one matters. And we bring those stories to life. We take the invisible, we make it visible, just like I do with the song. And ultimately what happens is you start to experientially feel what it's like to actually be living that particular value. And the amazing thing is as people hear stories of, you know, Susan, who, you know, showed up with integrity or whatever that might be, all of a sudden they're like, oh, I actually could do that over here in my department. Or I'm so inspired by Susan's story and how, you know, kind she was with that customer that I'm going to start doing that over here. And so I talk about this idea that we become what we celebrate. So the more that we celebrate stories of our mission, vision, values, and action, we actually, the more we become our mission, vision, values, and action. And so in a nutshell, like that's what I try to do within organizations. And there's a more nuanced discussion. Like there are of course forces that can be like destructive towards that. Like you just described us having these things stated, but not actually living them, but you can create greater alignment around them by actually just surfacing the moments where it's already occurring.
Yeah. And I imagine there's even some neuroscience around the more that we start doing that celebrating, the more that we notice things and it becomes self-fulfilling.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, there's, you know, one of the approaches that I'm trained in as a facilitator is something called appreciative inquiry. And ultimately, there's a lot to say about that, but it's about the sort of quality of the questions and the appreciative lens that we're putting on things. And so, you know, again, mountains of research around this, but when we can appreciate sort of the best of who we've been, the best of who we are, it tends to be one of the most effective ways for us to create more of that. We're actually kind of hardwired as human beings to focus on like what's wrong, what's broken. It's why that we'll click on the car crash video versus the somebody just walking through a field video, because we sort of want to notice what's wrong. But this approach of kind of highlighting what's right, what's working, it's not that you like ignore problems, but you kind of like eclipse them on your way to something better. Mm. And if you just think about it, like in your body from an energetic perspective, it's like, how does it feel to like notice what's wrong? How does that make you show up at work every day versus having a sense of possibility and seeing, you know, all the amazing things that your colleagues are doing and like energetically that makes you be like, yeah. Okay. I want to be part of that. I want to do more of that. And so That's the essence of what I try to bring.
I'm curious, what are there rituals or things that you encourage organizations to take with them long after your keynote concert is gone to make sure that this stuff becomes part of how they operate?
Yeah, there are many. I mean, every organization that I give a keynote to, I always leave them with a series of questions that I've custom built for them. One of the founders of Appreciative Inquiry is a guy by the name of David Cooperwriter, and he said the seeds of change are planted in the questions that we ask. So I put a lot of emphasis on the power of questions. So I always give them questions, and I sort of give them a quick crash course on how they might use these questions at, you know, the beginning of their meetings or their gatherings or their strategy sessions and so on and so forth. But even a simple idea, like at the beginning of a meeting, how do you start with heart? We're often quick at the beginning of a meeting to you know, get to the agenda and get to the details. And we miss the neuroscience that if you want people to show up with their best ideas, to feel connected, to feel innovative, you actually need to create the conditions for them to not just be there in their heads, you know, possibly in fight or flight. But we all use words like, oh, listen to your intuition, follow your heart, trust your gut. Like that wording is literally speaking to the fact that we have wisdom that lives inside our entire bodies. And if we want to show up and be productive and be connected and all these things, come up with the best ideas, the best business strategies, we actually want to create the environment where people can show up as their whole selves. Another quote that comes to mind is from a friend of mine who unfortunately passed away, but he was a brilliant physician, and he really researched the neuroscience of leadership. And this is, forgive me for the paraphrase of the quote here, but he basically said, you know, the purpose of meeting is not to get things done. It's to advance the relationship with the people around us in which the work can get done. And so if we're meeting with each other all the time, but we're not actually advancing our relationship, then we're missing out on the opportunity to do that deeper, better work together. And, you know, that's just one of the ideas that I bring forward.
Wow. I really love that. I don't think very many people listening would say, yeah, that sounds a lot like the meetings I have every day. I think the meetings that we have every day are just very agenda driven, outcome driven. Let's do this A, B, C, D. There's really no space left anymore for that kind of connection and furthering the relationship that you talked about.
Yeah. And I would argue, there's a lot, like if there's something that we could do asynchronously, we should do it asynchronously and then do what we can only do when we're live in, you know, with whether it's in person, like, you know, can be over Zoom, or whether it's, you know, in the physical office. We should take advantage of the fact that we're actually live with each other. And so some of the more checklisty kind of things, we can, you know, put those on the Slack channel and then do the things that allow us to actually be connected and ideate and be creative and, you know, bounce things off of each other in the meeting setting. And the thing that's been cool about, you know, not just doing the keynotes, but doing the facilitation work where I'm with an organization for a longer period of time, is I get to see the impacts of this over an extended period of time. And I'm thinking of this guy who walked up to me. I was working with a company for a year and a half, and, you know, about 8 or 9 months in, he walked up and he said, you know, I'm the head of IT here. And when you first talked about this idea of starting with heart, I thought, like, there's no way. Like, I'm a ones and zeros guy. My whole team is ones and zeros people. Like, this is never going to happen. And then he kind of paused and he got, like, emotional. He said, look, you know, the truth is, when, as much as I thought it was impossible, I also thought, man, that would be nice. Like, I've been struggling with stuff with my son at home, and, you know, it'd be nice to just kind of be a little more human with my colleagues. And so even though it felt uncomfortable, I, like, invited us to do, like, a human check-in at the beginning of our meeting. And then he literally started crying. He said, it's totally changed my team. He said, you know, we are more connected. We're more productive. We're, like, better at our jobs, and we like our jobs and being together more than ever. And so it's been cool to me to, like, not just have this stuff live as theoretical, but actually see it in practice.
Yeah, that's the other thing that struck me a bit too, Peter, as you were talking about that, this organizational transformation you talk about eventually requires some personal growth among the leaders that maybe have been a bit old school or, you know, shut off. And it can only, this organizational kind of change can only happen so far until some of the leaders have those breakthroughs, like the IT guy. I've seen that too. And it's, yeah, it's interesting. I don't know that people don't really realize they need it, just like, you know, Mr. IT guy probably didn't realize they need it until they sort of found themselves in an environment where it was permissible and encouraged, and they just needed a little bit of permission and freedom to think about it differently.
Yeah, one of my favorite testimonials that I ever got was, she said, you gave us exactly what we didn't know we needed. Which is a hard to sell, but, you know, it's great when people tap into that.
I can't believe we're out of time, Peter. There's, like, another 5 things that I was dying to talk to you about. Maybe we can have you on again. I feel like we skimmed over a bunch of different things, but I was just so excited about this. I can't thank you enough. Before we go, I'm wondering what you're most excited about now.
Oh man, I have a longer answer for that question. I know that we're at time here. I'm super excited to get this music out in the world. Like, that feels really present to me. And then I think kind of alongside that, and this is, you know, through a lot of work in therapy and mindfulness, is I'm super excited about sort of bringing a little bit back more into balance, that pure artist side of myself with the, you know, like, I kind of want to harmonize those parts a little more again. And I feel like having new music out in the world is going to help enable that. And so, I'm excited to feel a little bit more whole and complete, by having those different sides of myself, kind of activated again.
Yeah, that's interesting you say that, because when I was listening to you talk about it, I thought, wow, it's amazing how balanced. It feels like everything is harmonized between your speaking and these different passions you've got. But I guess when you're in it, it's always a matter of course correcting. Like, you're never in a period where you think, oh yeah, right now everything feels in balance. Or maybe you do, and then tomorrow it feels like
exactly
you need to course correct again. But that's amazing to hear. So for people that are interested and want to learn more, where can they learn more about you, Peter?
Well, we just relaunched peterkatz.com, so KATZ.com, and it sort of is more representative of like my speaking work. And then we've moved like the music stuff over to peterkatzmusic.com. And, you know, I'm at Peter Katz Music in all the social places. I'm sort of hit or miss on social media sometimes, but I'm working on that. Yeah, depending on when this is released, we're doing a really cool show on November 22nd at the Allied Music Center Theater in Massey Hall. So that'll be pretty cool.
Oh man, Massey Hall is my all-time favorite. I had my son go see his first show at Massey Hall maybe a month or so ago, and he just came back and be like, "Where? It's a place is magic." I'm like, yeah. "Oh yeah, it's a very special place."
Yeah. Well, we're in the smaller space there, but still, I've gotten to play on the big stage before, and it's pretty amazing.
That's awesome. And I'll put links to your website and Spotify and all the amazing places where people can find you. I just cannot thank you enough for this, Peter. It's been amazing.
My pleasure. Yeah. Thanks so much, Bob.
The Growth Mixtape Podcast with Bob Mathers is produced by Bespoke Projects. Music by Jean-Michel Walter Cronkite. If you enjoyed this episode, please take a moment to follow and rate us. When you do this, it helps to raise our podcast profile so that more people can find us. If you want to connect, you can find me on LinkedIn using the link in the show notes.